Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. I'm Susan Margolin, and I'm co-founder and co-president of New Video Group. We are a distribution company that's been distributing film and television content for over 20 years. And about 7 years ago, we started New Video Digital, which is a digital content aggregation company. We distribute to our partners include iTunes and Google, YouTube, Netflix, Amazon, Vudu, and many others in the space. Today we're going to talk about cloud computing and what it means for filmmakers. We're going to look at the economics of digital distribution, collaboration and transmedia opportunities, and the use of social discovery in marketing your film. In short, how the cloud impacts the way content is consumed and how films are made, distributed, and marketed in the cloud. Post-ownership cloud-based movability. It's a bit of a mouthful. It's a seismic change for our industry. We hear about the cloud every day, in subway, at the water cooler, online. It's in the zeitgeist. But how does it actually impact the creation and distribution of content, and how is our business affected? As most of you know, virtual servers make media accessible to consumers through any connected device with the promise of infinite storage and instant access. So what's happening is we're moving into an age in which the premium associated with owning physical things is being supplanted by access to experiences and services. Whether we're watching a film in a crowded theater or at home snuggling up and tweeting about a film while we're watching it, cinema is and always has been a social experience. Until fairly recently, physical products, tapes and DVDs, have been the only means of sharing and reproducing film. Today, film as an event has shifted from one on a fixed screen to a viewing experience that can be accessed and shared across multiple platforms and social networks. With instant access to virtually unlimited content in the cloud on the horizon, does owning a library become superfluous? So we're at an inflection point where keeping less stuff but having greater access has begun. So today we're going to look at what this means for the filmmaking community. It's just a couple of stats that I've collected out there that were pretty stunning. Netflix subs watched more than 2 billion hours of movies and TV shows in Q4. Wow. 42% of people surveyed recently by Deloitte said they'd streamed a film in the past 6 months. 42%. So clearly, filmed content has entered the digital age. We're going to be looking at what the economics of film distribution are in the cloud, how we educate the consumer about access to content, and then make them be willing to pay for it. Looking at a really important question, is the cloud's enabling of social discovery, demographic data mining, and highly targeted marketing and advertising a game changer for the independent film marketplace? And finally, we're going to look at how cloud availability enhances the collaborative process of filmmaking. And some champions of collaborative storytelling and social editing, like Joseph Gordon-Levitt's Hit Record project and the WeShare video site. And our panelist, Tiffany Schlein, will be talking about her initiative in a little while. So without further ado, let me introduce our esteemed panel. As research director at IHS Screen Digest, Dan Cryan specializes in digital media and analyzes consumer trends, and Dan's going to help us decode consumption trends and the economics of distribution in the cloud. Jonathan Zepp is head of strategic content partnerships in film and TV at Google and YouTube, and he's going to help us look at how to make content in the cloud a more compelling purchase option for the consumer. And Sean Berkeson founder and CEO of Prescreen, which is a curated social discovery platform. And Sean's going to outline for us how to launch your film in the digital space and how to use the power of social networks to market your film. And finally, honored by Newsweek as one of the women shaping the 21st century, Tiffany Schlein is the founder of the Webby Awards. Her latest film, Connected, an autobiography of love, death, and technology, premiered at Sundance. And Tiffany is going to be providing a filmmaker's perspective on cloud collaboration and introducing her new collaborative storytelling initiative, Mobile Films for Global Change. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dan.
And with a bit of luck and the magic of drumroll, nearly there.
You're on.
And resolve. We work. Okay, cool. So let's try and keep this relatively brief, sort of 5-6 minutes on a bit of a whistle-stop tour of the way that sort of content consumption and monetization is going, sort of for online movies. So if we look at sort of the way that this used to work, the way that's kind of ultra familiar to everyone, you used to have online video services, which were basically download services that initially went to the PC, and then you could load it from the PC onto other devices. So far, so obvious, I think, really. Things got a little bit better when you could start moving the content direct to the device from the service, but really it's only recently that things have got more interesting when we've started having the cloud, for want of a better term, in other words, have things centrally shifted around, allow you to start a video in one place and finish it on another without having to move the file around, without any particular faffing around with file management of your own accord, but actually just have the whole thing looked after by the automated system and the automated service. The people who have probably got this to be the most successful so far, most used, Netflix, but they're not the only people doing it. So things like Roxio Now have been offering similar functionality for a while, but it's really Netflix that has kind of driven this kind of multi-device seamlessness. And in doing so, rather inverted the sort of traditional approach to this. So the big movers in online video historically were, surprise, surprise, iTunes, Microsoft Zoom, and Sony's PlayStation. And the idea there was that you had an online service that basically supported an ecosystem of devices. Netflix have flipped this, so it's much more about having a service that services a collection of devices. It's kind of device agnostic, and it's the service which takes the fore. It's the service where they try and make their money, rather than trying to make the money from selling devices if you're Apple, selling video game licenses, etc. if you're Microsoft. It's a content service, and surprise, surprise, it's focused on the content itself. If we just zoom in on the Netflix subscriber base for a moment, it's a kind of paradigm, sort of interesting to kind of look at the paradigm shift of consumption here. So we start off back in the day, back in 2008, the dim and distant past, and Netflix was predominantly a physical-only business. And they launched this thing, Watch Instantly, and it's been growing ever since. Roll that through sort of 2010, where they launched the digital-only subscription in the US for the first time, and that sort of began to change. Then we had all the fun and games that they had to go through with their subscribers last year, to considerable acclaim, shall we say, from their customer base. But the upshot of this is that they've now got more digital-only customers than they do anything else. So they've pivoted that business. It's now become about what they call streaming, for want of a better way of putting it. It's really subscription video on demand. The number of customers taking the physical and the digital part is the bit that's taken the hit here. People only taking DVD actually grew last quarter. So people still like DVDs. There's a hardcore of people who are not giving up on the DVD piece for a second. There's about 2.7 million of them, but nevertheless, they exist. But the major shift has been the shift towards digital-only consumption, and it's that that lay behind the 2 billion hours of movies and TV shows that they did in Q4. So let's have a look at what this actually means in terms of total online consumption. What becomes fairly obvious is that the big usage there is Netflix. It's subscription video on demand. It's not only Netflix, of course. It's also Hulu Plus. It's also Amazon Prime. But Netflix is the lion's share of that big pale gray bar in the middle of that chart. It's far more popular than any form of transactional video on demand. It's far more popular than EST, than digital purchase. Consumers have massively moved towards electing to watch this stuff within a subscription environment. A reasonable quantity of ad-funded, mostly from the likes of Hulu, but also a few other providers. But really, the subscription has all pivoted towards SVOD. So let's look at this in traditional context. This is what happens when you put online consumption against the traditional home entertainment business. So DVDs, both rented and purchased. And what we've got is the point that the way things are going, that it looks like in 2012 we're going to have more movies consumed online than we have on physical formats. So this is literally the tipping point year. Significant change in the way that things are working out. We were heading there in 2011, but it's 2012 that really does it. And this is movies only, right? So this excludes all the TV shows that are consumed for Netflix. This is movies only. We do this in terms of viewing time. So transactions and views is a slightly odd metric, because you could start watching something, then stop watching it again. So if we do this in terms of viewing time, it actually looks like by the time we hit 2014, people will be watching more online movies than they will be watching movies on physical formats. So it's a real sea change in consumption. And really, this is tantamount to is a shift from a sort of traditional home entertainment mode of consumption through to a much more TV-like mode of consumption. And that's what you saw earlier with the business model flip, right? So home entertainment, you'd buy the disc, you'd take it home, you had the convenience of having a library that you could watch whenever you wanted. With streaming and with the rise of online, we've got sort of really a much more TV-like mode of consumption. And you know, surprise, surprise, in that TV-like environment, it's the traditional TV business models, advertising and subscription, that are coming to the fore. It's not the old home entertainment transactional piece. This is a couple of rather interesting consequences. So your traditional home entertainment transaction, DVD plus of rental and retail, was worth about $4.70 or thereabouts. So every time someone bought or rented a DVD, averaged across the two, it was about $4.70 of spending. Most of which, particularly if it's retail, went back to the studio, went back ultimately to the content owner in one way, shape, or form. When you flip this online, and purely to the stuff that people are paying for, it works out at about 50 cents per transaction. So there's a real flip in the amount of money that's coming into the system, even as this consumption is going through the roof. And if this sounds to you quite a lot like the sort of things that the record business have been saying for years, you know, oh, it's great, people are consuming more music than ever before, you'd be absolutely right. The problem, of course, as we know, is that the revenue pie has declined fairly solidly since about 2001 for the music business. It's only now begun to find a way that makes sense for consumers to sort of spend digitally. And again, ironically, driven by subscription. One of the things I heard on the panel the other day, which just came up on TV, let's just flip this a bit and pivot it, was someone stood up and goes, yeah, we all know how much TV is being watched in a non-linear way. So I thought, just for a point of comparison, I'd show, this is all online video, right? So we stepped out of movies for a moment. And not only online video, but all TV watched with a DVR. It's worth remembering that actually the traditional TV business, so people watching live linear TV, is still, roughly speaking, 90% of total TV consumption. So while we've got an online business that's actually doing more movie consumption by transaction and by the time we hit 2014 than done on sort of physical form, actually it's a tiny sliver of what's being consumed on traditional live linear television, which is a kind of interesting thought. One more slide for you. This is what happens when we do it as a revenue pie. The good news is that it does look at the moment as if online is going to stabilize the decline from this chart. I'm told by our guys that do physical that those physical numbers might be coming down a bit, though. So don't hold your breath for a complete stabilization of the home entertainment revenue pie just yet. But nevertheless, decent growth from the online sector, albeit possibly not as interesting and as shiny as people would like to hope. And that's really where I'm quite grateful it's not my problem, and in fact it's someone like John's. At this point he can try and tell us where things are going to try and up that level of monetization, because the way things are going, and I should emphasize, this forecast is based on kind of current consumption trends. We're allowing for things like windowing experiments and that sort of thing, but you know, we can't forecast a sea change in the market. We can tell you where the market is likely to be based on the current modes of behavior, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if John's got a rabbit in his hat, hopefully we'll hear about it here first.
But no pressure.
No pressure. Figuring out the future. Maybe.
That's another panel, I think.
So I think we're done.
Yeah.
Flipping. Okay. Good.
Just need a little clicker.
Do the click.
Thanks.
These were great, but I don't think we need to see them again, do we?
Thanks, Dan, Susan. So again, John Zepp, I'm with Google and YouTube and handle our strategic content partnerships for film and TV. As Dan put out in the slides, I think the one question that won't be answered today is what is the business model for consumption of film and TV in the future? And certainly that's a long debate and one that will evolve over the years to come. In our view, as a supplier of content, that's, you know, the cloud is not specific to any one type of business model. We think the cloud enables and potentially enables easy access to content through a variety of models, one of which could be subscription. I think certainly the data suggests that model has resonated well with consumers. But speaking on behalf of the studios for a moment, we do know that there is a strong hope and distributors of all type for a transactional model to continue to exist. The point that Dan made about the value that a distributor tends to see from a subscription model versus transactional is well taken, and I think we'll see over the years to come. Certainly a push by the studio side to try to retain the higher value, higher margin product around transactional in one form or another. That said, with respect to cloud on what it means today, I think it's interesting from a consumer standpoint and from a distributor standpoint to take a look back at how emerging technology platforms have helped shape access and accessibility to content in different models over time. Two factors in particular, portability and accessibility. So if you look at theatrical basically existed as a non-portable model with limited accessibility. Get in your car, go to the theater, do it on their scheduled time. The introduction of physical brought that experience finally to the home for the first time, and I'll couple in television and other forms of in-home media here. But limited portability, DVDs, sure, you can take and lug around, but not an ideal experience for kind of bringing the experience whenever and wherever you'd like. Better accessibility, but certainly not the end game. Digital, as Dan explained, really got into the, you know, for the first time with a downloadable file, being able to bring that experience with you and have accessibility to it where you'd like. We view cloud as really an evolution of this trend, right? So we view cloud as a service side provider, as bringing the experience really to a ubiquitous opportunity to view and consume content whenever and wherever you'd like for the first time. One question that tends to come up when you talk about cloud is really what is it? Why should the consumer care? And why does it matter? And is it as simple as just being a portable hard drive in the sky or a digital locker in the sky? And we think it's much bigger than that, because what it really does is it's a management tool for enabling that content on any type of device that you might like. To put it simply, we think the cloud is what enables the connectivity of content. So you'll hear connectivity of devices and TVs and all this, but really what connects the content is the cloud itself. So, for this example on this slide, imagine a transaction locally done on a PC or device that purchase, whatever it might be, whether it's a subscription or a rental or an EST product, is stored in the cloud, but it's really the management function that is the most critical piece that the cloud is bringing to the game. It's the seamless ability to push that content out from the device on which you've purchased it out to your plethora of devices that you might have amongst your device catalog or access to. That, more important than the storage, is really what cloud brings to the table. So regardless of business model, it's the accessibility and the portability that makes cloud, in our view, a consumer standpoint and a service-side standpoint, most intriguing. Gone are the days with cloud of thinking, did I sync my device? Did I sync my content with this device? Right? I mean, we've all had that experience. If you buy something and it's on this iPod but not this one, or it's on this PC, cloud eliminates that. It's thinking of it along the ways if you think of email today, right? You don't think of sign into this email account on this PC and have I brought over my emails? It's just there, and that's what cloud enables. So from the filmmaker's perspective, you know, we think the accessibility, the portability of cloud storage and cloud content really raises some interesting questions. Some of these are questions that, you know, the filmmakers will have to ask themselves. Some of these are questions that services like ours will have to ask themselves. And, you know, the rub between the two, I think, will play out in just, you know, the shaping of the industry over the next few years. But just to touch on a couple here, and then we'll keep this top level for now and would welcome any comments or questions later in the panel. But, you know, does seamless portability suggest shorter form content may translate particularly well? You know, we talked about devices being connected to the cloud and, you know, that experience going with you everywhere. So as the plethora of short screen or small screen devices increases, does that make content that is more suitable for those short or small screens play particularly well to them? You know, film is always going to be a big screen experience. We think there's always going to be certainly value in having a living room experience. But as you have more accessibility and more portability with content on your smaller devices, we do believe there'll be an appetite for content that is suitable for those screens in smaller bite-sized formats. Two, will improved accessibility increase ownership demand? So as we talked about, subscription has really been a big driver of the business the last few years. EST, which has been the industry's attempt to get a purchase model that replicated the success of DVD, hasn't taken off to the extent DVD has. There's been a big industry push around things like Ultraviolet, which is supported by five of the major studios, to try to make a cloud-based model and interoperability between ownership take off. Does this increase the demand for EST? I think Dan raises some interesting points that suggest it's probably not accessibility and portability alone that's going to make EST work, but certainly making it a more valued proposition to the consumer, having easier access to it, from the studio's perspective and from someone hoping to sell content, hopefully resonates better than what we've been able to do today with regards to EST. Tiffany will touch on this a little bit, but, you know, as we're looking at selling content, we are at the end of the day somewhat business model agnostic. Whatever resonates with consumers, we are happy to support, and whichever model resonates with filmmakers and content owners, we're happy to negotiate for those rights. We think cloud introduces a couple new models. I mean, the three traditional models today, transactional, subscription, ad support, are all evolutions for models that existed in other forms of platforms. What's really intriguing are the things that cloud could bring that's really unique, things like interactivity and social watching. So, you know, if you've ever created a Google Doc in the cloud, you know the experience of community-driven editing of that document, right? So take that experience, translate it to a film where you could then have, you know, social building of content in the cloud, bringing the true choose-your-own-adventure model to film, which has, you know, long been attempted but really not executed well to date. That type of potential now exists with the sharing and collaboration of content creation in the cloud. And then finally, this is, you know, kind of a personal question as someone who's licensing content from distributors who represent filmmakers, is what do the distributors who the filmmaker is working with, what do they think about cloud? I mean, we deal with a lot of different folks, whether it's big studios, small studios, aggregators, and there are varying opinions all over the map. You know, some studios fear the cloud because for the first time this could be a truly permanent purchase model, and the model of reselling content over and over from VHS to DVD to iTunes file to Sony file. Now if you create a cloud scenario that really truly is ubiquitous across devices, is this finally a permanent purchase? Is that something the distributors want to embrace, or do they want to frankly hold on to the model of trying to get people to buy the same content over and over? We from the service side tend to be on the consumer's view. We think that, you know, the rub between making EST successful probably does support a permanent model, and you know, we're happy to embrace that. But the questions that we'd put back to the filmmakers is, you know, understand the relationship you have with your distributor. What do they think with respect to cloud from a business perspective? Is that a shared philosophy that you'd have as a filmmaker? So with that, I'll leave it for some further dialogue.
Beautiful. Later in the conversation. Thanks a lot, Jonathan. Yeah. And I think that's a perfect segue into Sean's discussion about, you know, how to market your films and your TV content online.
Great. Thanks. Just a show of hands, real quick. How many people here are content owners? Okay. So about 50%. So we talked about deliverability in the trends of what the cloud means and deliverability means for content owners or people to take advantage of this movement. And, you know, I think as we think about what this really did, and it brought access for content owners to a much broader audience much faster, so it can be much more relevant. So what we're seeing here is a paradigm shift. I mean, you're now, it's a democratization of content. Consumers, aside from Disney, not many content owners have much of a brand name. Historically, it's been very transactional. So it's not about, hey, I'm going to go see a Warner Brothers or Sony movie. It's I'm just going to go see that movie. Now, what we've seen is micro franchises within that, with Harry Potter and Batman and such like that, where they're able to understand who the audience is and continue to reach out to them. So developing those enterprise relationships is huge. And so how does social media fit into all this? And hopefully I'll be able to shed some light on a little bit of that. So a term that's being thrown around loosely around here is, especially at South by Southwest, is digital media and social media. So how do you define digital media and social media? I mean, really, it's no different than media. And if I were to define digital media, instead of calling it digital or social, I would call it micromedia. Because what it allows you to do is it allows you to find the people that are most relevant to your content or to your movement or to your business or whatever it is, and develop an ongoing relationship with them. So social media is really no different than traditional media, except that you're able to identify and segregate it and reach the right people at the right time. So let me give you an example of the impact of social media. And a lot of us, I think about social media in terms of numbers. And it really should not, it's not about how many eyeballs you reach, but it's a matter of which eyeballs you reach. So are you guys familiar with fab.com? It's a fast-growing tech company that recently launched. Ashton Kutcher is an investor. Show of hands. Okay. Few of you. So fab.com, what they do is it's a flash sales site, mostly focused around design. Has nothing to do with content, but I just want to use it as an example. So Ashton Kutcher, who has 7 million Twitter followers, and Kevin Rose, who is the founder of Dig, has 1.2 million followers on Twitter. So they did an experiment. They both tweeted the exact same thing on the same day and see how it played out. So with 7 million followers, Ashton Kutcher, actually I've got bad eyes, I'm going to pull it up over here, hang on a second. All right. So Ashton Kutcher on day one tweeted, and basically what the tweet was a clear call to action. So for fab.com, if you click the link, it was $10 of instant credit towards that to Fab. So when Kutcher tweeted to his 7 million followers, immediately he had 5,888 users who joined fab.com. That's 0.08% versus Kevin Rose, who had 4,356 users who immediately joined using the same link, and that's 0.3%. That's also something we'll talk about in a second, which platform should you use, but we'll get there in a minute. So when you think about overall engagement, 0.3% from these people who are you're following on Twitter, who you've actively opted in to listen to what they have to say, is actually not all that great. But so downstream, Kutcher had an additional 719 people follow or sign up from people who retweeted. So 12% virality. Versus Kevin Rose, who had an additional 1,147 extra followers from retweets, which was a 26% virality. Now, this is where it gets really interesting. Kevin Rose is a tech guy who looks at early-stage companies, so those are people who are probably much more likely, number one, probably more affluent, and also, number two, much more likely to be engaged with what he's saying in terms of new technology and startups. So from those 6,607 total signups from Ashton Kutcher, it actually only generated $2,183 worth of revenue. For Kevin Rose, his 5,503 generated $7,121 worth of revenue, and that was after 1 week. So the other interesting thing was that there was 43 orders after day one from Ashton Kutcher's followers, which resulted in a lower transaction. So again, that total was from 43 total orders versus Kevin Rose, who only had 30, but they bought $7,000 worth of goods from fab.com. So the point there is, again, it's not about how many eyeballs you're reaching, but it's about getting in front of the right eyeballs. And so social media, or micromedia, as I like to call it, allows you to identify specifically who's interested, whether it be a website or business or specific content which you've either created or you're trying to distribute. So with that being said, the film industry, let's quantify that a little bit. There's a lot of noise out there. There's a lot of content. And even more so than this, what I'm going to share with you here is we don't look at it as my business, Prescreen, we don't look at content as studio content, independent content, stand-up comedy, whatever, or even gaming. What we care about is what are you spending an hour and a half of your day doing? If you're spending an hour and a half of your day on Facebook or social gaming, that's an hour and a half of your day you're not watching content. So we consider all of that competition. And so really what you want to do, again, is focus on the right eyeballs, people who are consuming content, and in curating it for them so that they're only seeing the right things. So you're putting the right movies in front of the right people at the right time. So just in terms of it, for the context of this panel, let's look at the film industry. So festivalfocus.org, the database, has 40,869 movies in their database. That's a lot of content. There's about 10,000 movies created every year. Of those, just under 4,000. Actually, I think this past year, in 2012, there's more than 4,000 films submitted to Sundance. Of those, there's 118 accepted, and of those, less than 40%, or 40 total titles found distribution. So 40 from 10,000 that were created that year. So long story short is you have lots of competition. The good news is that people are interested in different content. So by doing these mass market media buys, probably is not necessarily the way to go. In terms of social media and how you're supposed to market your film using social media, you have to understand that every movie is different. And unfortunately, social media is, there's no formula for success, and it's more of an art than it is a science. So you constantly have to tweak it, and you constantly have to use new platforms. In fact, this past week, there was an article that stated that Pinterest, how many of you guys are familiar with Pinterest? Okay, so if you haven't already, you'll hear about it soon. It's now driving, in its short time, I think it's now been at market and at scale for about 8 months, less than a year, it's now driving more referral traffic than Twitter. So although Twitter is a great tool, it's not the only tool, and maybe there's more effective tools, especially for what you're trying to get people to transact with. So the impact of new media on film, as we've talked about before, as these guys have touched on, the cost of distribution has drastically come down, which for the smaller guys is extremely exciting, and for the bigger guys, it's kind of unnerving. But what it's allowed us to do is understand who exactly it is that's interested in our title and be able to draw that trend line, recognize who those people are, and start targeted marketing. So I think in the future, as we're looking ahead, the next two to five years, you're going to see a lot less media buys and CPM buys, so cost per mille, which is per thousand. You're going to see a lot of CPAs, which is cost per action, so a direct buy or referral or a share, or a CPC, which is a cost per click. What's important about that is what you want to do, it becomes more of an optimization game. If you know who you're supposed to reach and you know your cost per click is 10 cents and you're converting at 10%, you know it's going to cost a dollar to get somebody to consume your content. If you're charging $4, you're going to do that all day long because you're netting $3. But if instead of 10%, you were converting at 1%, the economics may not work. So again, it becomes identifying who it is that's clicking, only putting the right clicks and paying for the right clicks, and then optimizing your site or your call to action so that you're able to make the economics work. So it levels the playing field, as I mentioned earlier. A good example, if any of you guys are on Facebook, we're at South by Southwest, so I'd imagine most of you are, you've probably seen in the last week something about Kony. Anybody? You guys know what Kony? All right. It's this what looked like an overnight success. And if you haven't, if you don't know what it is, go look it up. You'll Google it, you'll find it. But long story short, it was a 30-minute video that all of a sudden just went viral, or so it seemed. But in reality, it didn't. Social media is not something that just happens. It's not an overnight success. You have to work. They identified who their audience is. They embraced those people who were the movers and shakers and the humanitarians that helped distribute this movement. And they over the course of the past year. They've identified and aggregated people who were extremely interested in this particular topic. So they started with a couple hundred thousand people who were already engaged, and that then turned into a million or 15 million YouTube views in literally, I think, less than a week. So it's, again, it's not an overnight success. It's a long-term strategy, but it needs to be part of your strategy. What this could mean is, we believe, is potential collapse of the traditional windows. You'll see a lot more day and dates pre-theatrical to understand exactly who those audiences are so that you can go out there and target and market to these people directly. So what this means for you, instead of theaters and, you know, having a reach of 300 people in one specific geography, the potential there is you can fill up stadiums for the same piece of content, or with the same piece of content for the same amount of money, or even, you know, globally reach a worldwide audience similar to what Kony did. Kony did not spend very much money, although there was some, but their return on investment was huge. So what you need to ask yourself as a content owner is, you know, what is the opportunity? It's now easier to reach the masses. You can have much more efficient marketing. And which eyeballs are you going after? For your piece of content, you know, maybe you do need to be in the theaters. I mean, Batman, for example, the one that's coming out, everybody wants to go see that in the IMAX theater, and so you are going to do a theatrical release. But maybe you have a documentary that, you know, maybe as a filmmaker, you would prefer to see your movie on a silver screen, but in reality, your consumers are not consuming that on the silver screen. They'd much rather watch it online or at home. And so to put the right movie in front of the right people using the right format, it becomes extremely important. How to use it effectively, I'm going to skip this. That's social media. If you guys have more detailed or pointed questions, you can ask me a little bit later. What tools to use, we've already gone over Twitter and Facebook and Pinterest. For the sake of this panel, the other day on Thursday before I left, I tweeted and I Facebooked the exact same thing. On Facebook, within 20 minutes, as you can see there, I had, I think, 12 likes from all around the world in four comments, and on Twitter I had 3 retweets. So again, knowing what your content and how it resonates and what formats to use becomes extremely important. I've since created a company called Prescreen because what Prescreen does, it tries to level the playing field with all the tools that exist. It's hard. Most content owners are artists and not businessmen, and so where do you begin? At what stage do you begin? And so what we're trying to do is aggregate the eyeballs so that we can help you understand who your audience is and distribute more effectively. We'll skip this. We can get into more detail. If you have any questions about Prescreen, I'd rather, I think, leave some more questions, time for Tiffany and questions later, so we'll talk later.
Thanks, Sean.
Can I grab that clicker? Okay. So these are all really interesting, all these new data points. And I'm actually going to switch it a little bit and come at it as a filmmaker, because as a filmmaker, it's such an exciting time right now. And, you know, I started making movies on film, on celluloid, and then, of course, went over digital. But now, I think today, I'm kind of more excited than I've ever been in terms of how I can make a movie. So I had a film that premiered last year at Sundance called Connected. And premiered at Sundance, we had traditional theatrical around the country, and now we're in this window where you can license it, and then soon we will be over with new video, but our window's very successful right now, so we're kind of holding tight on you can organize your own screening, you can have it at a company or a conference or a school. But I'm going to show you a clip. Before I do that, I'm also really into, I think as things become more digital, I'm really into the tactility that goes with it. So we provide a lot of materials that go with the film that you can't duplicate online. So we always make discussion kits for our movies. They come with conversation cards and curriculums. So there is this added value, which we've found has been really successful. And I'm going to show you a clip from Connected that's just like a minute, but it really sets up how I'm making films differently. It was almost as if working on Connected And so this came out in January. I wanted to put into play what I was talking about. So here's the clip.
Still in its infancy, the internet is helping each of us to synthesize the two hemispheres of our mind. Clicking through the radical explosion of text information online is activating the left hemisphere. And linking from page to page, video to video, is stimulating the right hemisphere. The internet is literally changing the way we think, moving us through a constantly evolving landscape of words and images at the touch of a keystroke, synthesizing the two hemispheres of our brain. If this rewiring of the brain is happening on an individual level to each person who uses the web, imagine the cumulative effect of a Da Vinci-type brain synthesis on a global scale. Today, there are close to 2 billion people online. What would the world look like if everyone on the planet could be online? It's not that far away. There are already 5 billion cell phones on the planet. We're at the beginning of a participatory revolution. Interact, reproduce, and cross-pollinate instantaneously, creating new hybrid ideas that combine perspectives from all over the world.
So we call that section in the movie the participatory revolution, and the whole film kind of looks at the history of connectedness from the beginning of humans to where I think we're going. And so the participatory revolution, obviously, it came out in January, and we've seen so much, Arab Spring, so much stuff happening. And the way that we want to make movies has changed at my film studio. So we're really interested in activating the network into making the films. So we're starting this new film series called Let It Ripple, Mobile Films for Global Change. So the last line of Connected is perhaps it's time to declare our interdependence. So we rewrote the Declaration of Independence as a Declaration of Interdependence, and we posted it on the internet, and we just tweeted it out and put on Facebook, and we invited people to submit artwork and videos. And we were just totally blown away. We got, you know, videos from Haiti and Rwanda and Europe, and so then we edited together this, and I'm going to show you what we made.
In the course of human events,
it becomes increasingly necessary
to recognize the fundamental qualities
that connect us.
The truths we hold
to be self-evident.
Alors nous devons réévaluer les vérités que nous tenons pour acquises.
That all humans are
created equal
and all are connected.
比如, 每一个人都是生来平等并且联系在一起的.
That we share the pursuit of life,
la recherche d'une vie meilleure,
liberty,
la chirut,
happiness,
gebahagiaan,
food,
walrida,
water,
agua,
shelter,
el refugio,
safety, seguridad,
education,
prosperidad,
justice,
and hopes for a better future.
That our collective knowledge,
economy,
technology, and environment
are fundamentally interdependent.
Ketergantungan kita.
That what will propel us forward
لأن لدينا شجاع على التقدير
is our curiosity.
Our ability to forgive.
Kemampuan kita untuk memaafkan.
Our ability to appreciate.
Our courage.
Our courage.
Keberanian kita.
And our desire to connect.
D'être connecté.
Connecté.
That these things we share
حيات المطاف إلى تطور
to our fullest common potential
le cose che noi teniamo insieme sono le cose del nostro mondo
我们应该严肃对待我们的问题
we should never take ourselves too seriously.
Kwa sababu, jambo jingine linalotuunganisha
huwa kudrata na halata.
Dan upaya kita untuk belajar dari kesalahan kita.
So that we can learn from the past.
Understand our place in the world.
Memahami tempat kita di dunia.
Use our collective knowledge.
To create a better future.
So perhaps it's time.
Jadi mungkin sudah saatnya kita.
That we, as a species.
Sebagai spesies.
As a species.
We love to laugh.
Que disfruta de reír.
We love to laugh.
Use question.
Ask questions and connect.
Do something radical and true.
For centuries,
we have declared
independence.
Perhaps it's now time
that we,
as humans,
declare our interdependence.
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 That was our first experiment. So the second part of the experiment was we posted it on the internet and we asked people to help us translate it. And you have to understand, like, one of my other films that's been out for years has maybe been translated into, like, the tribe has been translated into 7 or 8 languages. So within 6 weeks, this was translated into 65 languages for free through an organization called DotSub. So as a filmmaker, you have to understand how incredibly powerful. Most of my films can only be seen in a certain amount of languages. And just that everyone wanted to do it for free was so powerful. And then the next part of our experiment was that we announced in December, I announced that I will make a version of this film for any nonprofit that wants to use it for free. So I will replace my call to action at the end of the movie with your logo and your URL and your call to action. So I'm going to show you kind of what it looks like so you get it, because it's kind of hard to get your head around. But so we work with them on their call to action, but like this one at the end, we changed it into declare independence by donating your old cell phone. So this is a wonderful organization that recycles cell phones called the Hope Phones. So we announced this in December, and we've already been able to make 75 free movies for nonprofits. And it's not hard for us to do. So if you're working with any nonprofit and you want a free movie to activate your base, we can do it to you. So we're making 20 films in this series. So we're making about 3 or 4 a year. We're doing one on money, power, happiness, empathy, death, the whole gamut of what it means to be human. And the next one we're working on right now is on, it's called Brain Power. And it's all about how to best nurture the brain. And we invited people from all over the world to send us videos of their kids running into their arms, because that'll be kind of the collaborative component, and artwork about how they envision the brain. And again, it's grown from the last time, because now kind of people understand what we're doing, whereas before it was just some random thing like, please send us videos. So we've doubled the amount of entrants we're getting. And it's really exciting. So we're editing the film, or you can still send videos. If you go to Let It Ripple, we explain what we're looking for. I think, you know, oh, sorry, this is my, when we do a call for entry, my film studio is called the Moxie Institute. So we're constantly trying to throw spaghetti against the exceeding wall of the internet and say, like, how can we make a film more collaboratively using the cloud? And I think, you know, if I think about when I first started to make movies, like, I went to NYU, the summer program, to get my hands on the expensive equipment, and how different it is now about how everything feels so much lighter. It's so much cheaper, lighter, collaborative. So I really think the qualities of this new ways that we're making films, they're collaborative, the tools are all available, we can make hundreds of versions, there can be short, they can be translated. Another attribute is sharing your failures on what works and what doesn't, because a lot of things don't work. And we're looking to innovate every aspect of how films are made, translated, and distributed. A lot of people use the term mass distribution, but I feel like it's mass creation right now. Abraham Maslow has the saying that if you have a hammer in your hand, everything looks like a nail. And I think since you have a camera in your hand, everything can tell a story. So as a filmmaker who's telling stories, there's so many new ways to tell stories today. I invite you all to kind of participate in our experiments because it is a collaborative process. But again, I've never been more excited about the potential of how you can make movies today with people from all over the world that you've never met before. Thank you.
That's great. Great. So I think we'll take this opportunity to, first of all, thank all of our panelists, but open up the floor to questions. And I think we have some mics in the back. So does anybody have a question for one of our panelists?
So do you think that the cloud opens up opportunities for collaborative consumption when it comes to film? I don't exactly know what that would look like, but maybe people going in on a batch of films, that way you sort of are able to preserve the transactional process, but then maybe bring up the buying power of a group of consumers.
Perfect. Sean, do you want to grab that one?
Sure. For those of you who don't know, I was one of the founders of Groupon, one of the original guys at Groupon, so collective buying and collaborative consumption is, I can hopefully speak to that. One thing that's extremely important when it comes to consumption is people are much more likely to consume what their friends are consuming. They want to be part of that conversation. So using socially enabled tools, for example, the Facebook Open Graph, so what we do is when you watch a trailer, it automatically posts to your Facebook wall. All of a sudden, all your friends know what you've been watching and what you may or may not have consumed. So they want to be part of that conversation. So absolutely, I mean, there could be models where people say it's only going to be available if we hit a certain tipping point. And some people, I'm sure you're going to see some people distributing their films like that in any different formats, whether it's in the theater or online or wherever. Tipping points or synchronous or asynchronous viewing. So at the point we get, 10 people to watch this, we'll film it all at the same time. We can type, chat, whether we're together or across the world from each other, we can still kind of consume this together. So I think, yes, I think that you're going to start to see a lot of new models doing stuff like that.
Just to follow up on that thought for a second, if you think about how people watch movies in the theater, collaborative. If it's at home watching TV, there's the whole business of either having friends around if it's a football match, or people will sit at home on the phone traditionally, and they'll watch the same program together. Netflix used to enable this thing when it was on the Xbox. It doesn't exist anymore, where you could watch Netflix in what Microsoft called party mode, where you've got your little avatars sitting around and watching the same film at the same place, and you can chat over VoIP. That got removed for various internal reasons because of the way that Microsoft sort of changed their relationship with Netflix, and it's done on SDK, But when it was still active, it was doing about 5% of total Netflix consumption. It was just being done collaboratively with people watching things in party mode together with their little avatars having a chat. As we understand, it's higher for things like live sport, as you'd expect it to be. But even with movies, yeah, people were using kind of new ways of doing it, in this case, avatars and VoIP, to watch movies collaboratively. It's a repetition of an old behavior. And generally speaking, the stuff that sticks is things which make old modes of consumption and old modes of behavior easier or better. So, yes.
Also, just imagine, if Facebook gets involved in streaming content, that'll be right, a natural...
Except for the current experiments to do transactional movies through Facebook haven't done terribly well. Because
why do you think that is?
Because it didn't have the one thing that every transactional online movie service has to have in order to succeed, which is that there wasn't a device play associated with it. So if you think about anything, you know, people have done web-based movie stores for years, and they didn't really take off. When they took off was when it started getting baked into in with devices. It was Apple iTunes, it was the Xbox, it was the PlayStation. Walmart's now doing quite nicely with Vudu, but why are they doing quite nicely with Vudu? Well, because it's on the PlayStation, it's on the Xbox. So you've got to get that device play in part, it sorted out if anyone's going to go and actually go and sort of, you know, buy the movie.
Yeah, when we eventually go online, we're talking to some of the companies, you'd imagine, about doing some experiments where you're really watching connected online and having a meaningful exchange, because it's like we're not quite there yet with that. That's interesting. I think it is with the device.
Yeah. Right. It's coming.
Next.
All very interesting stuff. One of the concerns that always seems to come up whenever I get in discussion with people about the cloud is security. And I was wondering if, in your opinion, there is any... If the security risk is any more heightened than it was in the past, and if so, what solutions might be out there?
Yeah, we as an aggregator, we deal a lot with piracy. I think that cloud distribution with established platforms is actually more secure than our current system. Do you want
to? Yeah, I mean, I would just add that, I mean, where the content is being stored with respect to a cloud service versus a non, it's kind of the same place. I mean, it's a server somewhere in Apple's landscape of servers or Google's landscape or wherever. I mean, it's on some server somewhere. The fact that the content is accessible to the consumer via the cloud, I think you're right, introduces more ways in which there might be the risk of harm. But in all of our deals and all of the folks who are seriously in this business in a legitimate way, there are very significant content protection requirements that are contractually in place. And it's certainly something that we take seriously, as does everyone else in the industry. I don't know that it increases the opportunity for piracy. I think, as Susan said, it probably creates more opportunity for legitimate distribution, which in the long run hopefully counters the problem.
I'm going to front this right now. Online services are more secure than DVD. End of problem. End of story. You look at most of the stuff that's available on the Pirate Bay early, before it's available over here, shed loads of that is coming from what? It's coming from Region Zero DVDs with Russian subtitles. They're released that way in Russia in order to try and reduce piracy in Russia, but actually what they're doing is they're feeding that's piracy over here. It's a DVD physical leak.
That's totally right.
Yeah. I mean, piracy is a huge problem, as
you
all know. Well, we are, just constantly playing the whack-a-mole game, sending out, DMCA letters to, various pirate sites.
But they take them down.
And for the most part, we've had success with, getting the sites to take them down. There'll be some territories that are out of our reach. We've had, some problems with China and Sweden and some other places offshore that, but I think you have to be really vigilant and set your Google alerts and send out letters and follow up to make sure the content comes down.
Can I add something to that? What we believe is, we're obviously as secure as the rest of these guys, but a lot of it is access to content. So there's been tons of studies that recently have been published, and I wish I had the facts and figures in front of me. I should have prepared for a question like this. I'm sorry. But if you want the article, I'll send it to you. But what they said is domestically, because people have access to it here, domestically, piracy was really a non-issue. I mean, it was less than 10%, and it didn't really affect the distribution because people did have access to it, and they're more than willing to pay for it as long as they have access to it. Where it becomes a problem are the territories where they don't have access to it. And with the internet, with as much, the flat world and people hearing how great these movies are and they want to see it, and they don't want to wait, that's when it starts to run rampant. So, one way to combat piracy is just allow access to it.
Good.
Do you see it becoming easier for independent filmmakers, owners, to actually access the public without going through an aggregator or a distributor, because that's right now, in order to get into the big guys, you actually have to do that. You can't do it directly. And I actually am right now signing up pre-screen for a film, because that would be great. But in order to play with the big dogs, you just can't do it on your own. And is that going to get easier?
Let me take this one first, just speaking from someone who does rely a lot on the benefits of working through an aggregator like a new video. I mean, I think we think that there are actually real efficiencies for everyone. So, you know, we, aside from the technological barriers of getting content up on a service, there's a lot of other parts of the process, from contracting to just, you know, management of files from point A to point B. And it's just impossible for a service like us or iTunes to go out and do a deal with individual filmmakers on a one-on-one level. It just can't scale. And also, there's negotiation, and there might be terms that you want to negotiate for that are different from someone else. So you can't have that one-to-one negotiation on a per-film basis. So we do think there are benefits and efficiencies of having an aggregator who can have those type of discussions with you guys and then give us just one point of content that brings in, you know, the thousands of folks that they may deal with. So I'd say from a service perspective, we're not sure the system's broken, so to speak. I mean, we want to encourage ways to make it easier for you guys to find credible aggregators and distributors that we trust and that we work with, and we want to negotiate with them to make sure that the terms that they're making available to you guys are terms that make sense for everybody. But, you know, speak candidly, I mean, we do think that there's a big benefit of having, you know, an aggregator person connecting the dots between service and filmmaker.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's very important to work with, you know, a company or a group that will help you plot your release plan, you know, from A to Z. The minute the film is in production, you should be thinking about, you know, what the ultimate distribution plan is and what the windows are going to look like and, you know, where the film is going to, you know, resonate and building your marketing plans for each of those platforms, because you can't really just go up on one platform. You know, you have to be in an ecosystem in order to maximize the value of your film. So that's really one of the main values that an aggregator, you know, brings to the table. I think, you know, the other thing that is very important is just making sure, again, we've had so many filmmakers come to us and say, well, you know, we've been up on this platform, you know, for 6 months, and now we want to go every place else. And, you know, that's problematic. And, you know, in some ways you might, you know, ultimately hurt the overall life of your film. So.
Yeah, I would just add one more thing too, which is there's, you know, the licensing agreements that iTunes or Google Play or Sony or someone puts on. I mean, it's not as simple as saying let's just decide how the rev share is split up and that's it. I mean, there's some fairly significant points that tend to get negotiated, and these guys have expertise. So sometimes it's taking the trouble away from the creative side and the filmmaker side to not have to worry about being an expert on content security schedules or things of that nature, and letting these guys who have had the experience and kind of track record, you know, fight that fight on your behalf.
Well, and I think every movie is different. So I think sometimes it does make sense and most of the times it probably does make sense to work with the aggregators and distributors, because they're going to open up doors that you as an independent filmmaker may not otherwise have. But a lot of distributors come to us and say, what do you see that's out there that's good? And so instead of – what we're trying to do is take the creative process out of the distribution process. So if you run on a site like us and we're able to define the market, tell you exactly who the market is, how big it is, who you need to reach, who you need to put this movie in front of, and all the statistics that go around that, you know, a lot of distributors would be more than happy to you know, have that game plan, then help you take it to the next level.
But, you know,
that's
on that
the
same
power of the cloud.
Yeah, but I think on the same token, a lot of filmmakers, you know, and I think this is definitely shifting, but, you know, they hope their film gets sold and they think someone's going to take care of it and thrust it out into the world the right way. And I think there's a real opportunity today that filmmakers can read so much about this and learn so much about it that you should be empowered. And I feel like you should be just as creative with how you get your movie out there as in making it. And I think a lot of filmmakers put all their energy and money and time into making the film. And they need to think of it as half the time. And the other half the time, there are so many new ways to get your film out there. You need to be just as creative and put just as much energy, love, and attention into figuring out the best path for your film.
Half the time and, you know, sometimes half the money.
Oh, right? For sure half the money. I'm sorry, I didn't say the second part of that. For sure, you need to reserve enough money to have the time to make educated decisions, because people that get screwed in deals, they're desperate, they're out of money, they're out of energy, and then they have no negotiating position, or they're not able to really investigate it. So, yes, thank you.